Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. By the way, our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, is now the place for smart coverage of the 2012 presidential race. Right now on the site, see Anna Sales' article about Tim Pawlenty's mixed record as governor of Minnesota and how that politically unusual state gives us both Al Franken and Michelle Bachmann. 2012 is starting now at itsafreecountry.org. Well, the hedge fund billionaire Raj Rajaratnam, as you've undoubtedly heard, was convicted for conspiracy and securities fraud in Manhattan federal court yesterday in what prosecutors are calling the largest insider trading case ever involving hedge funds. Prosecutors have been cracking down on securities fraud in general in the wake of the financial crisis, and central to the prosecution's case were tap phone calls between Rajaratnam, who was the founder of the Galleon Group, and corporate insiders from whom he got information. We'll play a few excerpts of those wiretaps coming up in just a minute. Now, Rajaratnam plans to appeal the verdict partly on the grounds that wiretapping his phone, like they would an organized crime chieftain or a drug trafficker, was wrong under the law. So joining us to discuss the implications of the case, John Coffey, the Adolph Burl Professor of Law at the Columbia University Law School. Professor Coffey, welcome to WNYC today.
My pleasure.
This was an 8-week trial. The jury heard lots of evidence. What was some of the most damning stuff that came out of these tapes?
Well, it's the combination of both the tapes, which can often be cryptic, and the actual participants in those conversations testifying as witnesses for the government and explaining what the conversation was about. So that the witness, you first hear the tape, and then you hear the witness say, what we were doing here was agreeing that I was going to get X thousand dollars for telling them about this. And then that puts it all in context, and you explain what some of the code words are. The jury obviously found that overwhelmingly convincing evidence.
Let's hear one of those wiretap calls, a little piece of one right now. This is Rajaratnam on his own phone. And listen for the tone of this, the kind of casual, matter-of-fact, it's another day at the office kind of tone, as well as the content.
I heard yesterday from somebody who's on the board of Goldman Sachs that they are going to lose $2 per share. The street has them making $2.50.
Really?
Yeah.
So he was talking about Goldman Sachs, I guess, and worried that they were going to lose a couple of dollars a share. It doesn't sound like some conspiracy or covert criminal operation being hatched. It sounds like, you know, some chat about something they know about a company being publicly traded.
I think if you listen to a Mexican drug dealer talking to his contact across the border about shipping a ton of cocaine across the border, they might also sound matter-of-fact. These are professionals, but they were engaged in probably the most abusive kind of insider trading, where a corporate director at Goldman Sachs was leaking confidential business information that belonged to Goldman Sachs to a hedge fund operator so he could trade.
What was he saying in that clip? And we have a few more to play. But if in something that short you can actually extract something meaningful, was there something illegal in that?
Certainly. He is telling you what the director learned at a board meeting, that the earnings were going to be $2 below what they had been expected to be, and that was going to trigger a market reaction. The market is always guessing what your next quarter earnings is going to be, and if that's tipped or leaked to a hedge fund operator, he has an amazing advantage over everyone else.
So let's hear another clip. This one more explicit about Rajaratnam recognizing that what he was doing was not above board.
I said something like, you know, there's a basket of semiconductor companies like Lattice, Fanchon, and Atmel. Right. See what you think, and you should say, Atmel and Fanchon look good, you know, so that we just
protect ourselves. Have a corporate record.
So, again, tell us what we were hearing there, and for the lay ear that's not in the hedge fund business, why is that damning evidence?
Well, if you are hearing confidential business information, what's important is not just that the information is material and non-public, but that it's being stolen, embezzled from the company because an employee who is expected to be loyal to the company is giving the company's confidential business information to an unauthorized source. In an increasingly technological economy, confidential business information is the most important property of high-tech companies.
Listeners, we have about 5 minutes if you want to get in on this conversation about the conviction on all 14 counts, by the way, of Raj Rajaratnam. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 with Columbia University Law School Professor John Coffey. Anybody working in the finance sector, react to this positively or negatively. 212-433-9692. So are there implications for how wiretaps are used overall? Just the idea that this was, you know, the same methodology that they would use going after an organized crime figure or a possible terrorist or a drug kingpin, I guess that's kind of new.
Well, no one is above the law. You understand why we do it in the case of an organized drug figure, but they're also presumed innocent. You are using these tapes only when you can convince a federal judge that you have probable cause to believe they're guilty of a crime, and then there are further additional requirements. You have to show that there was no other reasonably available method for obtaining this information, and you have to minimize your invasion of the person's privacy by clearly specifying the kind of conversation you're going to listen to. You can't listen to talks to his wife or to his lawyer about personal matters.
Let's take a call. Alan in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Alan.
Yeah, hello. How are you guys?
All right.
Good, good. I just want to say, I'm 28. I mean, I'm not in the finance industry, but, I mean, from what I think, this is a natural instinct to, like, just kind of cheat and, you know, get an advantage and cheat everybody else out of the, you know, to make money, you know. I don't think putting more rules and regulations is going to really do anything. It's just really about character and someone's morale, you know.
Alan, thank you very much. What about that, Professor?
Well, I don't think we need new rules and regulations for insider trading. The existing law is sufficient, but it needs to be enforced. We had major enforcement back in the 1980s, and I think after the Ivan Boesky and similar prosecutions, much of the industry stayed away from insider trading. Put it very simply, general deterrence works in the case of finance professionals. There's probably no group in our country that is more able to compare the relative cost and benefits of an activity than finance professionals. And what they've just learned is those costs have shifted upward and the benefits have declined.
It's interesting that you bring up relative costs and benefits because, in a way, I compare this case to the Bernie Madoff case. Here are two guys who were filthy rich, rolling in dough, had all the money they could possibly need for the rest of their lives without doing the things that they respectively did, and they did them anyway. Do you think that's an apt comparison, or what would you say about the numbers?
Well, I think Bernie Madoff was probably desperate this whole time because he was sitting on a Ponzi scheme that was sooner or later bound to fail. But I think what this case really means is it's a positive signal for the honest hedge funds and the honest expert networks, and it's a very bad signal for those hedge fund operators, expert witness networks, and research analysts who needed to cheat to stay successful.
But do you know any basic numbers about, or maybe it's a matter of speculation, but how much money would Raj Rajaratnam have made or would have if he hadn't engaged in insider trading compared to what he made with it?
That's a fair question, but the indictment alleges specific gains of something like around $50 million, plus some other profits on short selling. So I think you could say that the gains here are probably in the $50 to $60 million range.
So we're talking about,
he's a billionaire.
He's a billionaire. So
but he got to be a billionaire doing this for a number of decades.
Norm in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Norm.
Hi, Brian. Just a quick question. I was wondering whether the gentleman who is on the board of directors of Goldman Sachs and who has admitted to passing insider information on to Raj, whether he has been indicted, will he be indicted? And
well,
if not, why
question.
Hasn't he been indicted?
Good question. There were two people in that phone call.
He has not been indicted, I think because the prosecutor felt he only had circumstantial evidence against him at the time. But there is still a good possibility that he will be indicted. They may be able to obtain additional witnesses.
Listeners, before we end the segment, we posted this question to our Facebook page, that conversation ongoing. Do you think the guilty verdict and the use of wiretapping in the Rajarajaratnam insider trading case will keep Wall Street honest? Go to facebook.com/Brian Lehrshow. And to finish up, Professor Coffey, this is one guy who was caught doing bad things as one guy. But I wonder about the larger context here. Because, for example, our listener, Eva, alerted us on our comments page to a column by William Cohan in the Times yesterday where he described the growing anger over Wall Street corruption generally and the seeming lack of accountability throughout the financial crisis. The group called onmay12th.org, May 12th is today, is organizing protests at the headquarters of Goldman Sachs. There are similar protests planned around the country. And I wonder if you see this Rajarajaratnam verdict as part of a boiling over point of anger being reached in the country over the financial crisis, over the systemic failures of Wall Street and hedge funds, not just one bad apple.
Well, I think this is a lot more than one bad apple, and I think the public reaction to it could be fueled by that populist anger. This was, in fact, a criminal investigation that began at least a year before the failure of Lehman Brothers in 2008, so it wasn't triggered in its initiation by the financial crisis. More generally, I think what you're pointing to that most bothers the public is that while we can catch the insider traders, we've not been able to get anyone who was significantly involved in the marketing of toxic mortgage securities or the other practices that really caused the financial failure. Bad as he was, Mr. Rajaratnam is not responsible for the financial failure in 2008.
Right, and this may be kind of unsatisfying to a larger public in that respect. But in our last 30 seconds, what do you think it does mean for Wall Street or the hedge fund industry?
Well, I think it's a mixed signal. I think for the honest competitor, he now has a better chance. He was being beaten by hedge funds and expert networks that used illegitimate means, and he'd had to cheat to keep up with the competition. Now the honest competitor has a better chance of making a profit without having to face illegitimate competition. The dishonest competitor should be deterred, because what this case shows is that elaborate insider trading networks can come unraveled just like a loose thread on a sweater, and the whole sweater unravels, because once you catch one participant, he will probably turn and identify all the others to get leniency, and that's essentially what happened here.
Well, there may be a lot of other people on the street wearing frayed sweaters, quaking in their boots right now and looking over their shoulders and deleting a lot of emails. Thank you very much, John Coffey, Columbia University law professor.
Thank you.
And up next, we continue our series with historian Jill Lepore on events in American history that set up our politics today. Now, Karen Ann Quinlan and the politics of death, coming right up.